Medic one inbound to your facility. Emergency traffic on a 45-year-old male in cardiac arrest. Following multiple gunshot wounds. CPR in progress. Patient intubation. IO in place. Stay with you in 5 minutes.
Welcome to the EMS Handoff, your source for all things EMS. And now, let's welcome to the show your hosts, Bradley Dean, Eric McCullough, and David Blevins.
Hello, and welcome to the EMS Handoff Podcast. This is David, and along with my co-host, Eric McCullough and Bradley Dean, we are your source for all things EMS. It is us tonight, and we've got a controversial, fun, informative conversation. I think it's all of those in the mix, but you have myself and Bradley Dean and Eric. We're all going to kick this off, and before we do this, see how things are going to go over there in Murfreesboro, Middle Tennessee. Eric McCullough, how you doing?
Oh, I'm good. Things are going good. It is melting here. This is the hottest day we had. After returning from the conference and getting back to work and all that fun stuff, just kind of been sitting here and dealing with how hot and miserable it is, but I know it's only going to last a few more weeks and it's over.
That's it. That's it. And we're going to turn around in just a couple weeks after that and be like, where did the summer go? You never really know. So let's blast off over into North Carolina and check out Bradley Dean, who's been out doing some water rescue, I think. What kind of stuff you've been doing?
So today, I mean, for the past week, we've been doing some water rescue stuff, some dive stuff. It's been great. Today, the water was like a warm bath. If I wouldn't have gotten in trouble, I probably would have gone scuba diving, skinny dipping.
And ladies and gentlemen, this is the series finale for the EMS Handoff. As nobody wants to...
Well, you know, some people would love to picture that. Others wouldn't.
Others wouldn't. And I'm going to tell you, Bradley, I'm sorry. No, not doing. You know, but you know, we really can't complain sometimes in this gig because, you know, I don't know how many times we've been able to practice rappelling off the side of buildings, you know, and it's all fine and good until the alarm goes off and you're hanging up upside down. Locked in and you have to flip over and drop pretty quickly. So water rescue is always fun. Got love taking the boat out and doing what we needed to do. But you know, sometimes we just have other topics. So we're going to get into that here in just a second. But before we do, we want to make sure and say thank you to our podcast partner, the Journal of Emergency Medical Services. Jim's has been a great partner to the EMS Handoff podcast since we rebooted from our episode many years ago. And we want to make sure that while we serve as your source for all things EMS and the podcast verse, you go by their website at jims.com to find out what they're doing to keep the industry moving forward. You can also check out all of our previous audio versions of our podcast, as well as our fellow podcast host on the EMS Today podcast. You can find it at Apple, Google, and Spotify. So make sure and go by and give them a subscribe, rate, and review and let them know what's going on. And Bradley, I don't know if you check it out here, but I see Eric sitting there wearing the nice Keep Back 500 Feet podcast line. I have to say that I'm not wearing today. I did not change over. My bad. But he is wearing that nice Pursuit Company Keep Back line that we have. So make sure to go by and check out thepursuitco.com. And you'll find under the affiliate page, the EMS Handoff. And you find all of our cool merchandise line from our original logoed stuff that we see back here over my shoulder to the one that Eric is wearing now. Again, that's the pursuitco.com. Find under affiliate page EMS Handoff. So, Bradley, we have been in the midst of COVID now for a little bit over, actually sitting tying in right on a year and a half. A lot of conversation here has been discussed lately with the Delta variant and a return to some of those numbers that we've seen before, increase in the daily positive count, seeing hospital bed availability start to decrease again as well. We're going to get into some of those topics today, as well as our recent Facebook post that we got some of the feedback from each one of you, our members. So Bradley, go ahead and kind of dig into where we're going today.
So I thought it'd probably be interesting to talk a little bit about the COVID vaccine and what it means to you. You know, a lot of healthcare agencies across the country have taken a stance and mandated the vaccine. And I hear a lot of outcry from individuals about, you know, personal rights and everything else. So one of the stories I want to kick off with is there's a story about people on a boat. So a guy decides to dig through the floor of his cabin because he wanted to see the water and what was below. The water starts to flow in. The other passengers, you know, they kind of get pissed now because, you know, he's dug a hole in his cabin. Water's flowing in, but it was his cabin, so why should it matter? Well, personal choice only goes so far when we're all in the same boat. And if we take a step back, let's look at history. Let's look at everything else. What I want to do tonight is I want to put political sides to the side, and let's have a very frank discussion about the COVID vaccine, what it means to us as healthcare providers, what it means for these healthcare agencies who have mandated the vaccine, and for personal choice. I don't want us to take a stance on one side or the other, but let's look at the facts about what's out there, what we've got. Because if we look at the eradication of smallpox and polio, these are diseases that decimated populations. And we've been able to control lots of things through vaccines, vaccinations, you know, over a period of time. We'll talk a little bit about the history, a little bit about where we are with COVID. But, you know, if we could isolate ourselves from each other, you know, vaccination would be much less important. But we are a social environment. We live in a social community where we have interaction with other individuals. You know, we've seen over the last 18 months that social distancing does not really work. You know, we're seeing about 2,500 cases or more increase across the country every day. The idea or the ideal situation would be 70 persons or less per day across the country being diagnosed with one of the COVID variants, whether it's the COVID-19, the Delta, or the Lambda, which are all out there now. So, you know, I don't like being forced, you know, to do anything, but I also understand the greater needs of society. You have to have a license to drive a car. You have to have insurance to do the same. You have to, you know, pay taxes or lose your freedom. So the list is endless. You know, there are things that we have to do and the things that we need to do. When I went into the profession of healthcare, I chose to put my health and that of my patients as a priority. And I can't do that if I'm sick or tell them that it isn't safe by refusing something that we know that science shows is safe. And what I'm going to encourage all of our listeners to do is read the science, not the media. I've heard an outcry over the last 4 or 5 days since our healthcare agencies have mandated the vaccine that said, well, what about the research that's been deleted from the internet? The research that is peer-reviewed has not been deleted from the internet. Media has changed things. Social media has posted things that are flagged things that says, well, this is false information. Because unless you're actually reading the peer-reviewed data, you're just feeding into the social, you know, environment. So we've got to be really careful. And as a professional, I expect healthcare professionals to read the research. And when I say that, it's peer-reviewed research. Don't watch what's on CNN and take that as the whole gospel, or what's on Fox and take that as the whole gospel. We've got to look at this. I will tell you, I will disclose this up front. I made the choice to roll up my sleeve for the overall health of society, for my fellow friends, professionals, and my family. So I took my vaccine as soon as it was available. But that's where I stand on the situation. Now we'll talk a little bit about the science. Like I said, we'll put politics aside, but we'll look at it. What are your thoughts?
So when we talk about putting politics and social media aside, I think it's so hard to do that now because it's baked in our social circles, like whether we like it or not, biased or unbiased, conscious or unconscious or subconscious, however you want to talk about it. It's really difficult to separate those two. So I think to get into the more granular details, we talk about don't take social media. I think it's easy for us to just look at Facebook or Instagram or Twitter and stuff and just kind of hear about the horror stories about people getting a vaccine and then getting sick or dying or stuff later, but not getting into the granular details of that information or even knowing where the primary source of that came from, or was it just a thing that you saw in passing? So, I mean, thinking about all the elements that go into that, because like you said, we're social creatures. We are not just socializing physically, but also online. And I would argue that has way more influence on our behavior from a socioeconomic standpoint than even our interaction face-to-face, because we are constantly inundated with algorithms that are seeking our attention, giving us new information, whether it's valid or not. And some of the information that's baked into it can be political in nature or not. So, you know, as much as we'd like to treat politics like oil and water, the problem is I don't think we can, but I think we should at least do our darndest to try, because I don't think it's necessary. I don't think it's appropriate or professional to just say, just forget it. This is how we're going to approach the subject, and like it or not, that's how we're going to deal with it.
Well, and I'm going to go along with that, Eric, as well. One of the things we take a look at is if we look at social media, it becomes very easy to gain a lot of information. All of the news sources and such are out there designed, embedded in all the social medias, and they take the opportunity to give you pieces to bring you in. I mean, obviously, when we take a look at it, news is just like anything else, it's a business, and they're trying to bring you their direction. The one thing that I am going to say with all this, and I'm going to go ahead and disclose it on this group, I am currently not vaccinated. And, you know, I continue to look at all of the information that's available. And, you know, I commonly say that I'm not for, not nor against the vaccine. The one thing that I do say for everybody is to find a trusted and learned source for that information and have the conversation through your research and determine where you're going to go. Now, I'm in a little bit of a different boat because I'm not in the clinical side. So when I'm out and about, I typically try to maintain my distance and do what we need to do to remain safe until the thing passes. And as we get through here, there's going to be a lot of points that I kind of bring out and want to discuss as well. So I do find it very interesting, but the one thing I know, and we'll find out through the next hour here, that we can have this conversation from vaccinated and unvaccinated individuals and do so in a way that makes us all hopefully better. Learned disagreement is a good thing because as we take a look back through medicine, there's a lot of things that at one point in time were extremely considered the standard of care, only to find out they actually caused things to get worse. And then there's things that were done that actually, had we not done them, then we would have had, you know, the eradication of the entire human population. So do not use Facebook and Instagram and LinkedIn as your primary source. If you find something that interests you, take a look at it and go back and research. I'm one that Wikipedia is a great resource, not necessarily for the material that's on it, but the reference sources that you can go back and find. And so always take it. If you find a good piece of information, then pull that onion back or pull the string, peel the onion, whatever analogy you want to use until you get the information you need.
And you guys will probably notice that over the last 6 months, I've been a little bit faster to respond to text. That's because my 6G and thought to text works great since my vaccine. But no, seriously, So the whole thing is, you know, we've really got to look at a little bit of history. So I'm just going to roll back about 10 years. So 2009, 2010, we had the whole issue with H1N1 and the swine flu. We thought, you know, that was going to be, you know, really bad. You know, we thought it was going to be 10 times higher than anything else. And it wasn't quite as bad because there were certain control measures and certain things that were put into place. But, you know, social media, while it was pretty prevalent then, was not as big as it is now. And we were a transient population then. But, you know, 10 years in 2019, we were much more of a transient population with ability to travel and things being able to move much faster, which really changed the dynamics of the landscape. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and share my screen, if that's okay with you guys. And we'll look at a few things here with COVID vaccine and what it means for you. So please feel free to jump in at any time that we're looking at this and we're talking about it. So, you know, one of the big things that I can tell you right now that we're looking at, and I want to go ahead and disclose this and tell you that I want to thank quite a few individuals for the information that we've been able to put in here. Jose Cabanas and Jeff Williams, the two medical directors from Wake County EMS in North Carolina, were very instrumental in information and stuff that they shared, along with Brent Myers, who was the medical director for ESO, Paul Pepe, and some of the Eagles were some of the physicians that I've talked to over the last, you know, 6 to 8 months about the vaccine. So they kind of guided me and helped me look at multiple things out there. And I will tell you, they've got a really mixed review of how they feel about it as well. But, you know, we're seeing a significant uptick in cases across the country as protective measures are relaxed with COVID-19. And we'll talk a little bit about those numbers. And everybody's going, well, you know what? We really didn't see anything with the flu. We haven't seen anything with the flu for this past year. Well, that's because these protective measures, the mitigating factors were in place with people wearing masks. So we saw a huge decline in the number of flu deaths. But if we look back at 2017, 2018, 2019, each one of those years, we saw an increase where there were somewhere in the neighborhood of about 490 to 500,000 hospitalizations for the flu and about 34,000 to 34,500 deaths during 2018-2019. Now, we're going to compare that in just a minute to something else. Right now, I can tell you that our hospital bed capacity is getting low. We're seeing some issues with healthcare personnel having an uptick with the COVID illness. So we're seeing that our healthcare individuals begin to decline, and we're seeing an uptick in hospitalizations, and we're in July. As we move into September, October, November, if things kind of run the direction they're running, we're going to see much more of an uptick. And we've seen this in the past. Anytime you look at any, you know, pandemic ebbs and flows, you see that. If you look all the way back to 1919, the pandemic that we had there killed an estimated 50 million people around the world. And that's because things ran rampant. But we're also during, you know, we had a very transient population. We had a lot of communal living because that was during World War I. So, you know, the pandemic of 1918-1919, if you look at that, some things that happened in the 1950s with the Korean flu, and then you've kind of moved forward with 2009, 2010 with H1N1, all of them have the same spikes. So somewhere in the neighborhood of about 20 to 24 months in, well, we'll see another spike. The good thing is we have the vaccine. The good thing is we've done some protective measures that were not done during some of the other pandemics. So as of last night, so I was kind of pulling a few things and putting them together. So when we look at the latest map and case count, there are 34.4 million cases of COVID. And this is just from the United States, 34.4 million cases of COVID, with 610,000 deaths from COVID-19. 610,000. How many did I say were there for the flu in 2018, 2019? Only 34,000. This is much worse.
Let me go ahead and jump in right there, because I know this is one of the big things when you get into a lot of the conversation. The term from COVID gets a lot of individuals when we're talking about this number. Because if you take a look at one of the instances, and this has been a considerable period ago, I think we were in probably the 1 year or even maybe just a tad bit less. The CDC had revised a number and basically said that about 6,900 deaths were from COVID. And the hundreds of thousand others were with COVID. And so when we take a look at this, you know, this is where we get into a lot of people saying, well, places were only labeling things as COVID deaths because of funding, et cetera, that was going to be available to them. So 619,000 deaths that are associated with COVID in some mechanism. Because as we know, and I'm sure you're going to get into a little bit, when we're talking about any kind of virus, especially one that's novel or unknown previously, as far as these iterations, we don't know how the body is going to react. So it could be that, you know, their COPD or their emphysema or their congestive heart failure or their something else may be a little bit, may be worse than previous, right?
Right. Now, so let me go back to this number, and you bring up a couple of good points. So there are lots of things where people say, well, you know, if they label it a COVID death, somebody gets so much money, this idea. That is a social media, running rampant. I also serve as a local medical examiner where I live and work. And I can tell you that if someone dies in a traffic accident, then it is listed as a traffic fatality. It is not listed as a COVID death. Even if they may have tested, you know, COVID positive and they shouldn't be out driving, that is not what they died from. They died from the other. So social media seems to run things pretty rampant, and people take that. Now, if somebody dies from a respiratory complication from COVID, yes, those certainly get listed as COVID.
And then let me also go into one other area as well, because this is one of the others that kind of goes around and really kind of ties to this number. When you take a look at it during a normal flu season, because flu is something that's been around, it's been studied, et cetera, they'll tell you if you have flu symptoms, unless you're in a life-threatening emergency, don't go to the hospital, don't go to the doctor, it's the flu. And then even during that, if we're in our normal flu season, then and we have a fatality, bodies aren't, or blood tests aren't run to determine if COVID is there. So we are hyper aware when it comes to COVID. At least this is based on my understanding, my research. We are testing those fatalities and taking a look at where we may not have done that with the flu. Am I correct in saying that as well?
In some cases. I mean, for example, you know, we're not, you know, necessarily testing everyone. You know, if it's an accidental thing or whatever, if it is, you know, respiratory, if it's something else, then certainly they may get that. If they're hospitalized, they present to the hospital prior to, then they may get that test prior to their death. So that's certainly a possibility.
And I think that's where we start thinking about the social media aspect of this is there's just enough truth behind everything that's said, whether it's from a political body, a political person, or even a seemingly innocent Facebook post, that it can run rampant. And yes, there may be some truth to it. It may be out of context, maybe within context. I think we're going to, like, I'm of that mindset of the hypervigilance on the COVID-19. I work part-time at a pediatric clinic. And before, we were testing everybody and their mama for COVID. You know, just everybody right. Got tested. Then all of a sudden, it went, now it's RSV and still no flu. So I see where they're coming from, and I think that's the main battlement, is when they see graphs like this, is, I guess it's that source of not only not just believability, but like the deaths that are occurring from it, because it's terrible. I mean, I've had friends and family who have died from COVID, not with COVID, from COVID. So I understand this. I understand the heart behind it, because I have people who I'm connected to intimately on that count list. And it's still, heck, actually, we have somebody here in Nashville who is a radio personality, Phil Valentine. He is a conservative radio host. He's in the hospital being hospitalized right now because of COVID-19. He wasn't anti-vaccine. He's a little hesitant about telling people to go out and get it. But that's where I think we get this weird like mesh of like the truth is out here with the science. The problem is the science changes all the time. And one study will say this, then you'll have another professional say this, and then they'll see this on social media. And I think everybody knows not to take everything from social media, but they'll validate those news sources from other places. And they're like, well, hey, 70% of what that thing said was correct. And so I don't think there's a lot of hashtag conspiracy theories. I do think we're seeing hesitant, even in the face of the facts right now, that like even that you're presenting, you're like, yes, here it is. Here's the number. It's 0.017% death rate. It would still suck if it's you, because then it's 100% if it's you. And real quick, since y'all told your vaccination status, I'm going to be the third weirdo and tell you that I am not claiming my vaccination status. I'm not going to let people know whether I have or have not. So I just want to throw that out there.
And that's okay. That's perfectly fine. And I think collectively, as a group, one of the things that we need to put out there is each person that's listening to this needs to make their own decision. I can tell you what mine was, but in looking at the data we just talked about, if you look at the 14-day change, it's 172% increase in cases. So we know that it's an issue. So of the 34.4 million that I talked about, just over the last 14 days across the country, we've seen a 172% increase, and a 57% increase in hospitalization, a 19% increase in deaths. Just some daunting numbers that are starting to pull up. So will there be a fall 2021 resurgence? Really difficult to say. It's difficult to look beyond the 10 to 14 days, but we can try. I'm very fortunate that, when I went to grad school at Wake Forest and then did some, post-grad research stuff with Chapel Hill and looking at Johns Hopkins is one of the schools that we did some collaborative stuff with. They've got some really good modeling stuff out there. And so last night I kind of played with the numbers and I ran some models and looked at some stuff. It's really difficult to go beyond 10 to 14 days, same as it is with the weather. So here are some basic data things that I came up with this. No vaccine, the virus run rampant, and results can be devastating. Supply, demand, and hesitancy. Here's where we really get into this. One scenario assumes that the demand is going to be high. Most people who say that they might get the vaccine eventually get it. We get up to around 83% of the eligible population gets vaccinated. In the low vaccination or high hesitancy scenario, which is currently where we are, because lots of people are really, really hesitant to get their vaccine, we assume that just under 70% of the eligible population actually gets vaccinated. And if we stay below that 70%, that's where we're really probably going to start to see some issues. So the other dimension is, the control measures, we continue to put those in place. So this is where we wear masks, maintain our capacity rules. We do the physical distancing. Notice I said physical distancing because I don't like the term social distancing because of, we are human. We're very social creatures. I think we should remain physically distanced while we remain socially connected, if that makes sense.
I completely agree with that.
So in scenarios with a 60% more transmissible variant. So right now, We've got two additional variants out there besides just the COVID-19. We've got the Delta variant, and we've got the Lambda variant. So when you plug the numbers into the hub, you know, they expect a national surge of cases to grow over the summer, which is what we're already seeing with the data I just showed you, with that 172% change, 57% increase in hospitalizations, 19% increase in deaths, peaking around mid-September or early October. The reason that our healthcare agencies have said you've got to be vaccinated by end of September, 1st of October, is because they're trying to mitigate the next spike, which is also when, you know, schools are open, you know, seasonal effects start to kick in, we start to have more social gatherings. So increasing that vaccination coverage from 75 to 86%. Remember, a while ago, I just talked about that 83%. But nationally, that will help curb the wave and cause it to decrease quicker, but it will not prevent the surge. And the reason I say it will not prevent the surge, that's a predictive analysis, is because I see and I understand the hesitancy of individuals. So surges will be strongest in states with lower rates of vaccination. I can tell you right now, North Carolina is somewhere between 43 and 46%. It's not enough. We're going to see the surge. People are going to die, and that's their choice. Unfortunately, I've had friends that have died from COVID-19, and my thoughts and prayers go out to their family, but they made their choice. And each one of you that's out there, the only thing I'm going to tell you is physical distancing, wear your mask, get vaccinated, make your choice. So the transmissibility of new variants has greater impact on future cases than raising vaccination levels. So a 60% more transmissible variant will result in the surge regardless of vaccination. And the variants that are only 20% more transmissible may not. Right now, we don't know what the transmissible rate of the Lambda variant is going to be. We know that the Delta variant is kicking Louisiana's butt right now. And historically in the past, anytime that we've seen a shift in a virus transmission, that variant transmissible rate is usually lower. For whatever reason, the Delta variant has not been. So we'll see what happens in Louisiana. Looking at the vaccine things across and the rates across the U.S., there's been 340 million doses given and 162 million people that are fully vaccinated. So across the country, that's 49.5% of the population that is fully vaccinated. With that being said, regardless of what political camp you reside in, there are a couple of things that we've got to make sure that we understand. The Trump administration and the Biden administration both jumped on board and said, you know what, the only way out of this, the only way to move forward out of this pandemic is to put the control measures in place and put a vaccine out there. That's why Operation Warp Speed was so important in getting things done and getting things moving forward. And then when the Biden administration stepped in, they wanted to deliver 100 million doses in 100 days. And they've done that to make sure that we get that out there for the population, for the individuals that make that choice. So as we look at this, there are two main things that we're going to look at tonight, the leading vaccine products that are out there. There are others. There have been some that have been released in the United States, but the two main ones that are out there right now, because the release of the others has either been pulled back or stopped with administration for whatever reason. I'm not going to dive into those, but Pfizer and Moderna are the two popular leading vaccine products that are out there. And we're going to talk about their efficacy. We're going to talk about everything with those for just a couple of minutes as we look at this. So let's talk a little bit about the historical, political, and scientific background. And I wanted to dive into that because I think that's really important. So life, liberty, and the pursuit of vaccines. So when we kick back and we look back across the United States over the last, you know, couple hundred years, well, 300 years, we know that things have run through colonies, through communities, when we look at the indigenous population before we began to, you know, move into the country. So in 1721, Cotton Mather, who was a Puritan minister, he kind of promoted the science. He said, you know, there's really something behind this. And we started looking at smallpox because smallpox was decimating the population. Well, 1730, 3% of those inoculated in Boston died, which was 2 out of 72 people died. And then in 1974, John Adams was inoculated. In 1777, George Washington ordered all soldiers to be inoculated because there were more deaths due to smallpox than from combat because of the communal living and the transmission rate. And then in 1782, Thomas Jefferson and his family got inoculated, but it wasn't until after his four-year-old died from smallpox that the rest of the family got inoculated. So looking at the history, people say, well, we've never mandated stuff. Things have never been mandated before. Well, we've mandated the flu vaccine in 1777. George Washington mandated that all soldiers be inoculated. And I can tell you, anybody that's been in the military has received vaccinations, whether you wanted them or not. And some people hit the floor after they got them, but you got those shots. So let's talk a little bit about from inoculation to vaccine for just a minute. So when we start looking at, you know, what does that mean? You know, we call them vaccines. Well, vaca is cow in Latin, which is the variole vaccine, which is Jenner's own translation, smallpox of the cow, is kind of where we came up with the word vaccine. So, you know, every time you get a vaccination, you know you're not getting something from a cow. It's just where the term comes from. So vaccine was the eventual term for inoculation with cowpox rather than smallpox. And in 1796, vaccinations begin. In 1980, the World Health Organization declared smallpox eradicated. It took from 1771 till 1980 to eradicate smallpox. That's a long time. So we're not going to wipe this out tomorrow. COVID is not going to go away, regardless of what political camp you're in. It's here. We must deal with it, and we've got to move forward. So what do vaccines do? So there are three key features that we've got to look at. First thing is, there's an antigen. So there's a protein sequence. And then we've got to use some non-infectious vehicle to get that into our body. And then that's got to activate the immune system. So the first step on the way to victory is to recognize the enemy. So our body has to have that antigen or has to be introduced to that antigen, whether it's programming, whether it's introduction to the actual antigen itself. So our body can then serve up that protein sequence so we can recognize whatever that invader is to attack it so it doesn't make our body sick. Now, can we still get sick from it? The answer is yes, not from the vaccine itself, not from whatever, but we can still get sick from whatever that antigen is, but the vaccine mitigates how our immune system responds. So it allows it to respond faster. So the goal is, you know, future exposure to any infectious antigen with the same antigen will produce no disease or mild disease. Prime example with this would be hepatitis, for example. So many healthcare providers have received the hepatitis B vaccine. So what happens is your body recognizes that antigen. It makes a protein sequence against it. If you are exposed because you got a cut on your arm, a patient has hepatitis B, your body sees that, it recognizes it, it mitigates that virus, destroys the virus that's invading your body, doesn't allow it to replicate, and we're good to go. Same thing with smallpox. So those that had the smallpox vaccine. Same thing with the varicella vaccine or chickenpox. Once your body has that protein sequence, it recognizes it, it mitigates it, activates the immune system, destroys that so it doesn't replicate throughout the body. Your body does store that. We'll talk about that a little bit later, maybe. So how does this work? Well, so the first thing is each vaccine has certain proteins and protein sequences that are on the surface of that virus. So that vaccine wants to replicate those antigens or those proteins so your body can make an antibody. Here's where some misnomers are coming about in social media, which we'll talk about. So, for example, the top left one here, you see measles. So that's the existing pathogen. That existing antigen on that pathogen, on this one, looks like a triangle. So the antibody has to recognize that triangle. It then attacks that triangle, so your body doesn't allow that virus to begin replicating. So then it destroys it, locks it out, gets rid of it. Same thing with chickenpox. It looks like the little cross that you see on the top right. The flu, for example, which we talked about, the H1N1 just a minute ago, that's the hemagglutinin and neuraminidase proteins that are on that actual virus. The body recognizes those, plugs it in, says, okay, we can destroy this, we can break the sequence, you can't replicate. Now we have a new pathogen that has entered the population. The one on the lower right looks like that little square. That is the spike protein on the COVID virus. So now your body has no protein to that virus because our population has not been exposed to it until recently. So in order to make a vaccine that recognizes that protein, we have to do something. Either one, be exposed to it, get sick, and hope we survive, or two, go through the vaccination development process, which we'll talk about in just a minute, so our body can then recognize that spike protein. Now, there's some things in social media that say, okay, now your body's making these spike proteins and everything else, so those spike proteins are going to cause blood clots and everything else. That's not what happens. Your body is able to recognize those spike proteins so it can fight against it. So with that, what we're trying to do is we've got to have a method to serve up the antigen without infection. So cowpox and smallpox viruses share some surface antigens, which is why a general was able to take cowpox, because he was able to say, hey, you know, people who have been exposed to cowpox don't get smallpox. So he was able to take that. Now, that was using somewhat of an attenuated live virus to be able to replicate those proteins. So find a virus that does not cause harm to humans, but has the antigen is one way. So that's what we did with the cowpox. So some of the historical types of vaccines and things that we need to look at. So these are variations on the theme. So AstraZeneca vaccine, J&J, and others used, one of these methods. Also called a protein subunit and vector vaccines. So different types of vaccines that are out there. So live attenuated virus vaccines that we've talked about a little bit, tuberculosis uses a live attenuated virus, the oral polio vaccine, measles, rotavirus, yellow fever, all of those use live attenuated virus. When we start looking at inactivated, so whooping cough or pertussis, there's also the inactivated polio virus. Many others, when we start looking at this subunit or purified antigens, which was the Hep B vaccine. And then there are some toxoids. So all of those are different types and different things, which caused a little bit of an issue, which is why Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca vaccines are not currently on the market. But we have the two main ones that are still on the market right now that we're going to look at, which use mRNA. These are the latest development. There are no viral particles of any type that are included. The messenger RNA is created in the lab to cause the body to make the antigen. So basically what happens is the mRNA vaccine gives your body the blueprint to build its own proteins. So it gives you this protein sequence via the normal synthesis pathways, but the way and the groundwork that has been developed before this, and which is some of the stuff I've looked at grad school, when I was in grad school and post-grad stuff, is this was already in development. This was already being done with several other things. When we start looking at anti-rejection medications for transplants and other things to be able to recognize cells as their own. But the mRNA created in the lab basically gives your body the protein, or gives your body the blueprint to make the protein to recognize the spike of the COVID virus. Okay. Which is why we were able to do ultra rapid development in 62 days from the time the COVID-19 spike protein sequence was known. And here's what's really, really cool about this. So Pfizer and Moderna vaccines are of this type. They're the mRNA vaccine. And they were developed independently, two different labs, within 12 hours of each other. One had it in the morning, one had it by 7 p.m. that night. And I can guarantee you they were not talking, you know, and they came out with roughly the same thing, which we'll talk about in just a little bit. So the reason we were able to do this so fast is because, you know, if we recall the 62 days from knowing the sequence to having the vaccine, worldwide attention generated more than sufficient volunteers for individuals to say, hey, I'll volunteer, I'll do that. And the prevalence of disease is high. So it didn't take long to have a significant number of infections to be able to really research and look at this a little bit better. And then the emergency use authorization and other processes allow for later review of many of the other factors. So immunocompromised people, patients less than 18 years of age, and so forth and so on. And I can go ahead and tell you that even, you know, though I had my vaccination, you know, I was one of the immunocompromised individuals because I have, unfortunately, an autoimmune issue where I fell into the category where it was not necessarily recommended that I get it. But at the same time, in speaking with my medical directors and my physician, the comment to me was, you're around people that are sick and infected, get the vaccine, you might live. Don't get the vaccine, you get COVID-19, you're likely to die. So that was what moved me in the direction, of course, understanding the research and seeing this, that I got the vaccine for myself. So, you know, what about waning immunity for COVID-19? Will a vaccine even last? So one of the studies that was out there says, you know, a result of low cumulative viral load or initial inoculum, essentially resulting in a very minor or transient infection that barely triggered an adaptive immune response in some individuals. Nevertheless, immune memory consisting of at least three immunological compartments was measurable in about 90% of subjects that were inoculated. So basically, it says, indicating that durable immunity against secondary COVID-19 disease is a possibility in most individuals. So we know that this is going to last. Exactly how long? We're still looking at that. But that programming, that sequence, and the ability to build, because we've given your body the blueprint, we know that it's probably going to last. So a lot of people say, well, it may not last, and we may have to have boosters. That's okay. We went through the same thing with hepatitis B. And we see now that hepatitis B is going to last or has lasted. So Wall Street Journal says, you know, pharma deserves the Nobel Peace Prize for the COVID vaccines. I will tell you that the individuals that developed this absolutely, deserve the Nobel Peace Prize because we are at a turning point with this virus. Right now, we're seeing an increase every day of about 2,500 individuals that are becoming infected. With appropriate effective vaccinations of 80, 83%, 86% or greater, and protective measures in place, physical distancing, mask wearing, all the stuff that we need to do, which I'm going to tell you, I'm not a fan of wearing a mask. we can drop that to 70 individuals a day. And that begins to really mitigate and limit that transmissibility, as well as the ability of the virus to mutate into other variants. So let's talk a little bit about vaccine safety and efficacy. So what is emergency use authorization? What is the safety and efficacy profile? What are the potential side effects? And what, if any, are the contraindications? So the first thing we've got to do is we've got to understand efficacy versus effectiveness. And I don't know that a lot of individuals really know or understand and look at the difference of efficacy versus effectiveness. So when we talk about efficacy, so when we administer in a trial setting, will the vaccine prevent symptomatic infections in the trial population? That's what we're looking at. Measures include confirmed cases over time as well as side effects. It's randomized to make effectiveness, you know, most likely by removing any confounders and mimicking the general population. Now let's talk about effectiveness. So when administered to the general public, will the vaccine prevent disease and in the pandemic? We're looking at that now. And depends upon compliance, education around the known side effects, logistics, et cetera. We've got to get the vaccine into individuals. If we don't get it into individuals, we're not going to know what the effectiveness is. Phase one recipients have opportunity to set that example. Each one of these has been through phase one, phase two, and phase three trials, which means that it is perfectly safe, even though we're under what we call emergency use authorization, which we'll talk about as we move forward. So let's talk about the evidence for emergency use authorizations and why it's important for individuals to understand what EUA really means. So you're right. You're sitting there thinking, it's not FDA approved. I don't want it. Well, you're right. It is not what we call the final phase of the final FDA approved. It is approved for emergency use authorization. We're looking at this from the pandemic standpoint and being able to drop the infection rate down significantly. And that's what emergency use authorization is for. So how do we even get to emergency use authorizations? Well, they still have to go through phase one, two, and three trials, and they have to meet certain parameters in each one of those to even be considered by the FDA. So the Vaccines and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee has to approve that. So on December 10th, 2020, the FDA briefing document that was sent out, this is where Pfizer met with the FDA and said, here's our phase one, phase two, and phase three trials. Same thing happened 7 days later with Moderna. But let's dive into this document. This document is about 50-some pages. I think Eric's got a copy of it. He's going to post it in the show notes, or at least a link to it. Yeah. Okay, so we're going to share all these documents with you. So these are peer-reviewed. All this information is what went to the FDA. This is not something that is done by the government. And there are people that say, you know, this whole thing is a conspiracy. If you've ever worked for the government, I can tell you that nobody in the government would agree to get all this stuff in line. So there's no way that this is a conspiracy. So emergency use authorization. So that is authority granted to the FDA to make available a drug, a device, or test that may be effective to prevent, diagnose, or treat serious life-threatening diseases. If you have taken a COVID-19 test to see if you were positive anytime between November of 2020 and March of 2021, you used something that was approved under emergency use authorization, whether you realized it or not. So don't say that the vaccine is not approved, but you're going to use something else that wasn't approved either. There are lots of things in the pre-hospital and in medicine that we do that are not FDA approved for whatever we treat it for. A prime example is, you know, Haldol for behavioral patients. And there's a black box warning, but yet we continue to give that because it is not FDA approved for what we're using it for.
Yeah, that's like steroid shots in the knee or the back. I bet a lot of people don't realize that is a non-FDA approved. In fact, can lead to complications later on in life that have to be diagnosed. Like you could have subarachnoiditis. But they call them off-label use, which means it's not FDA approved, but it is off-label use for that, which I'm sure many of us actually engage in those activities if we give any sort of medications in the back of the ambulance.
Right. And we do it all the time. And individuals don't think about that. So emergency use authorizations, not FDA approved, just like some of the other stuff is off-label use. Now we shouldn't confuse the two, but emergency use authorization, there is stronger evidence that the public will benefit from this than some of the off-label use stuff that we do. So, first in 1938, since reauthorized at various times, including by the Project BioShield Act of 2004, which when we start looking at some of the other stuff that was going on at the time. And so there was a Pandemic and All Hazard Preparedness Act of 2013. So there has to be a declaration from Department of Health and Human Services, Department of Homeland Security, or the Department of Defense that there is an emergency for this emergency use authorization. So the maybe effective standard uses a risk-benefit analysis based on the totality of science and evidence available. So when we look at the totality of science and evidence available in the documents that we're just talking about from December 10th that was presented to the FDA and December 17th from both Pfizer and Moderna, no, it is not full FDA approval, but they said the public will benefit from what we're going to approve. So the effectiveness standard for full approval equals substantial evidence. Now, are we going to get to full approval? The answer is yes, but that takes longer due to more studies and relaxed timelines and a couple other things. For example, everybody probably remembers Ebola and the threat that it was going to cause across the country. We had the Ebola antigen test that was approved. Freeze-dried plasma, for example, which people have been using for trauma and other things, is also EUA approved. It is not fully FDA approved. Nerve agent auto-injectors, people carry atropine and Tupam chloride. Those are EUA. Yet we've had those on the ambulances since 2001 for a threat that really didn't exist. But that's something else that we'll get into at a later date. So let's talk about getting an emergency use authorization for COVID vaccines. So February 4th, 2020, HHS Secretary declared a public health emergency. So laser focus on vaccine versus, the usual FDA timelines is kind of where we got to the whole thing of Operation Warp Speed. So we had concurrent trials, analysis, and production of vaccines all going on at the same time because we knew the science with mRNA with laser focus was going to work. Phase one basically looks at that safety and dosing. Phase two, more safety and what is the body's response? Is it going to produce the proteins, the antigens, serve up that protein sequence? Phase three is more safety, efficacy in large numbers. And then trials were completed for these vaccines, just like other drugs and vaccines. So the trials were there, but because of the laser focus, there were things that were going on simultaneously that don't normally happen. So on December 10th, 2020, the meeting of the FDA's Vaccine Advisory Committee, independent experts, some specialists, some consumers to recommend emergency use authorization was recommended. So the FDA accepted the recommendation and they issued the EUA for the Pfizer vaccine. 12/11 through 13, the CDC Advisory Committee recommended whether a vaccine should be offered to the American public and shots could be administered, and boom, they went out and that began to happen. So when we look at the safety and efficacy profile, we start looking at lots of unexpected adverse events. So, what were the side effects? So that briefing document will be available to you. But when you look at that, the safety data from about 38,000 participants with median 2 months follow-up, the adverse events considered, you know, plausibly linked to vaccinations generally start well within 6 weeks of the person getting it. I followed them for 2 months. Serious adverse events for participants during the study period did not differ between the groups. So, for example, you know, did they have appendicitis? Did they have additional immune reactions? Did they have any MIs, strokes, deaths? All of those were unrelated to the vaccine and the individuals that they were following. Now, they had some expected adverse events. So side effects were frequent and most time, mild, moderate. So pain at the injection site, fatigue, headache, chills, muscle, joint pain. And there were 64 cases of lymphadenopathy. So basically, you know, what that means is, you know, they had, you know, sore throats, swollen lymph nodes. But most of those, you know, went away and within a couple of days. So we look at the Pfizer phase 3 trial efficacy. And when we start to focus in on this, there were 8 patients who received vaccine, got COVID. Everybody says, well, if I get the vaccine, I'll get COVID. We'll talk about that in a second. But if you get the flu vaccine, you're not necessarily going to get the flu. You can still get sick, but it's going to mitigate the effects of the virus and how the virus is allowed to replicate in the body. And the individual should be healthier. When you look at this, 162 patients who received a placebo got COVID. 9 were severe. So when you do the math, the vaccine has a 95% efficacy after 2 doses. So looking at that, so the primary study endpoint starts at 28 days on the graph, 7 days after the second vaccine is when the individual really starts to have the increased protein sequence to be able to recognize that. So you'll see at this point, you'll see a divergence at or about day 10 to 14. So you see the benefit about 14 days after dose 1. Still need to wear your mask. So just because you get inoculated today, get your vaccine today, does not mean that you can go without your mask tomorrow. So there's no any protection during the available follow-up period. Moderna trials. Phase 1 trial was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Phase 3 safety and efficacy info based on 11/30/20 news release. And then they met with the FDA. Likely similar efficacy and safety profile to the Pfizer vaccine. So when we look at their data that was published and presented in December 17th, 5 patients who received the vaccine got COVID. 90 patients who received a placebo got COVID. The vaccine has a 94.5% efficacy after 2 doses. So both of these are effective. And there again, you see the same divergence on this graph with Moderna that you saw with Pfizer. And we start to see the benefit about 14 days after dose 1. So the Moderna trials. Some antibody detection after the first shot, but all participants had antibodies after the second shot. So both doses are important. About 30,000 participants, 185 patients in the placebo group got COVID, 30 were severe, 11 patients in the vaccine group got COVID, 0 severe cases. So that's about 94.5% efficacy. So the common side effects were injection site pain, redness, fatigue, muscle and joint aches, and some basic body things. So the numbers here are based on the Pfizer data. They're very comparable. So most people will probably get a little worse, you know, than what you get after a flu shot. Consider some, you know, ibuprofen or acetaminophen. But the placebo group reported side effects too. So let's look at this. The placebo group, they didn't even get the vaccine. 47% versus 33% said they were fatigued. It's 2021. We've been dealing with this for almost 2 years. We're all tired. I'm not worried about the fatigue that some people report just because they got a little bit of sugar water in their arm. Okay. So headache, fever. So they have side effects, more likely to be more frequent after the second dose. The other part of this that I really wanted to note is side effects are signs of your body's immune system at work building antibodies. For your immune system to work, you're going to have a little bit of increase in fever maybe, and all the other side effects. You cannot get COVID from the vaccine, and the vaccine does not alter or change your own DNA in any way. It just gives your body the blueprints to build what you need. So the technology is very similar between Pfizer and Moderna. Safety and efficacy is very similar. Side effects are very similar. The practical considerations, you know, cold storage, shipment allotments, you know, all that are something to be aware of for those of you that may be working with some of the logistical side, you know, side points. Now, a couple of things as we wrap up here. The vaccine will be offered to those less than 18, but there are limited studies. She has some of the contraindications. One of my daughters, I let them make their decision themselves. So I have one that is a type 1 diabetic. She made the decision that she wanted to get the vaccine. The other one made the decision she did not want to get the vaccine. I did not force either one of them to do it. I allowed them to make their own decision. The vaccine will likely be offered to pregnant patients at some point, not currently, and it's not included in any of the studies. The duration of vaccine effectiveness is obviously unknown, so there are some ongoing studies with everybody that gets this. The vaccine effectiveness against asymptomatic carriers is unknown. And then we know that when people get sick with COVID, it takes a few days. They can transmit it even though they're not sick. So that's something to be aware of. That's why we still need to do the physical distancing, still need to do masks in some settings, especially healthcare. Vaccine effectiveness against transmission in particular, you know, asymptomatic persons is unknown. So we've got to get individuals vaccinated in order for the vaccine itself to work. So basically the technology surrounding teaching our body, mRNA, to make antibodies against proteins has been around for years, which helped ramp things up quickly. The emergency use authorization follows strict rules and requires rigorous data and analysis. Even though the amount of studies required is less than what's required for full FDA approval, it's still very rigorous. And COVID vaccine safety and the efficacy profiles are very reassuring. I'm going to make a very bold statement here and say the best thing we can do for our families and our countries is probably roll up our sleeves, get the vaccine. But that's an individual decision that you have to make. Eric, anything you want to add to that? Because I think we lost.
No, it's a lot of good, thorough information. I like that you distilled all the science that's been coming out. So, you know, it's not hot potatoing the science or hot potatoing the studies from one resource to the next. I think another thing is getting resources from sturdy places. It is weird though, right? Where we live in a world where we're told to trust the science, be mindful of the science, but then sometimes we don't follow our own guidance on that. So I'm with you. I understand the hesitancy and the anxiety. I don't necessarily think that we should be doing it based off of faulty or bad information, that we should make the best decision based on our own research that we do, not just from, you know, Facebook and Instagram messages that go around telling you what you're supposed to do. Because like we said, they can obscure the science a lot, and the science is ever changing. The stuff that you just went over is the most updated information. Like I hadn't seen, I reviewed your notes before, but I actually hadn't really gone into detail until you did. So no, this has been really good.
Yeah. And I think we lost David. So
yes. Oh yeah. David said he was having some issues with connectivity and stuff. So he didn't get out because he was offended or anything by the topic. We'll make sure we understand that. He got out because he literally had connectivity issues. So yeah, barring that, that was just fine.
So I will say as we wrap up, you know, that's what we think. Yeah, we want to know what you think as listeners. Please feel free to sound off on our Facebook, LinkedIn, send us a message. We wanted to present you with the basic science, the information that's out there, what is emergency use authorization? Because we want our fellow healthcare professionals to make an informed decision based off of the science, not Facebook, not any of the social media outlets out there. It's very disappointing when I see professionals, you know, post and share things that have no, you know, scientific rigor or anything behind them.
Yeah, and I think that's the cautious thing is we want to make sure that we're making balanced, well-informed decisions and not just going off the cuff, because a lot of people, friends and stuff, are going to trust us with the information that we have. If you're in healthcare, you're probably the closest thing to a healthcare professional, you know, that they have. So they'll text you, they'll ask you questions and stuff. So it's always good to have an answer, you know, ready to go.
So in wrapping up, you know, that's what we think. Again, we want to hear from you. From my co-host, David Blevins, Eric McCullough. We want to thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening. Feel free to send us a message and always remember the value of your EMS handoff.